Going Linux, episode 143, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux. In today's episode, listener feedback.
And we hope you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
Today's episode of Going Linux, as always, or as recently always, has been, is brought to you by Audible.com. Right now, to receive your audiobooks, you need to use Audible's proprietary player in Windows, Windows in a Virtual Machine, or Wine. Since they don't yet have a player, they still don't yet have a player that runs natively under Linux. If you have one of those options available to you, then we have a special URL that you can use to sign up for a free audiobook and a 14-day free trial.
If you can't or won't run Windows or the proprietary audio player, we'd like you to sign up for your free trial and then contact Audible at http://audible.custhelp.com to let them know that you want a Linux player so that you can listen to their content on your operating system. If you're an open source software developer, we'd love it if you'd contact Audible at greatideas@audible.com and help them in their efforts to develop a player for Linux. And if you do that, let us know what they said, what the conversation was like.
Yeah, we haven't heard from anyone that's a developer that has actually done this, although I'm sure some of you have at least tried. Please let us know if we're wasting our breath here or what. In the meantime, continuing with the Audible commercial here, the place to go to get our special offer from Audible is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. Get a free audiobook and your 14-day free trial by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. That's AUDIBLEPODCAST, all one word, .com/goinglinux.
Well, that's done.
Okay. And for our listeners who heard me on the recent episode, that's episode number 66 of the Mintcast, you already know this, but I have switched full-time to Linux Mint. Yes, I am using Linux Mint Debian Edition, also known as LMDE, and I have abandoned what we were recording our last episode on, Tom, and that was Zubuntu 11.04.
AKA the steaming pile.
No, that was Ubuntu. I was actually recording last time on Zubuntu, so let me set the record straight. Zubuntu wasn't a steaming pile. It actually worked just fine, except for a couple of niggly little nagging things that made it difficult to actually record a podcast, which is what I do three times a month.
Sure.
So I kind of need those features. So, you know, the advantage of a rolling release like LMDE is that you get your application updates automatically, even when there's a new application that's available only in the next release of the main Linux Mint. And one of the disadvantages is, of course, that you're on the bleeding edge of things and things might break. But Mint has done its homework. For example, I have been, of course, using Firefox 3.whatever, and all of a sudden, Firefox 4 showed up as part of one of the regular updates. And of course, if you were on Ubuntu or Linux Mint, the version that, the standard release that used version 3, you wouldn't get it until you upgraded to the next release. But on the rolling release, I got it in the repositories. Now, I had tried to manually install Firefox 4 before that, But what I noticed was it wasn't quite right. The window decorations weren't right, and the font wasn't quite right. So I uninstalled it because it didn't look right. But
yeah.
As soon as I got the application upgrade through the normal update process, you know, pushed by LMDE, it has everything working correctly. It looks beautiful. It works just great.
Huh. Well, I've been using Chrome, and I just love the heck out of it.
Yeah, you know, Firefox 4 looks a lot more like Chrome now. It's got the tabs at the top.
Sure.
You know, that sort of stuff.
What I like about Chrome, well, one of the things I like about Chrome is up in the address bar, let's say you want to search Google for something. In Firefox, you're going to have an extra little bar there for Google or for search or whatever. Mm-hmm. You go right up to the address bar in Chrome and type in how many teaspoons in a gallon. And it says, okay, this is not an address. He wants to search for this.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're typing it, it's trying to guess what you want. So it's throwing out suggestions.
Ah.
So it might, you know, there might be how many, it might say, well, I'll do it right now. How, and it's suggesting howtoforge.com, how to tie a tie, how I met your mother. All right, no. Many.
How did you meet my mother?
We better talk about that off here.
Okay.
She was working in Atlantic City sometime. She liked my knife throwing gig. So, anyway, now I've typed how many, and it's suggesting how many calories should I eat? How many calories in a banana? How many ounces in a cup? So, as you go along and type things, it guesses what you want, which is wonderful for lazy people. You don't have to completely finish what you're typing. If it guesses right, you just scroll down to that and hit it.
So it's basically working like the Google homepage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. That's not bad. Not bad at all. And of course, looking at Firefox 4, I noticed that if I type the same thing, like 16 inches in feet, in the Google search bar or in the URL bar, I get exactly the same response.
You do?
Yeah. So I'm thinking they may have updated that in Firefox 4 as well.
Oh.
I was thinking that they had done that, but I wasn't absolutely sure until I just tried it.
Okay.
And kind of interesting.
Well, that's enough of us. Shooting the breeze, as they say.
Exactly right. So, hang on a second, Tom. I just want to try something here. 1 + 2. Classic fallacies. 1 = 2. Now, what happened? This used to work. 1 + 2. If you did try to do math, it used to just do the math for you and display that as a result. It's not doing that even when I do the Google search. Maybe it's because it's Linux Mint's Google search. Let me try something else here. It's using the Linux Mint search page here. 1 + 2. Which is really annoying, actually. No, that's... Don't tell the Linux Mint folks I said that. So let me just go to google.com. There we go. 1 + 2. Yeah, and it does exactly what you just said. Huh. Okay.
Mine says, I in Chrome, I punched in 1 + 2, and in the dropdown, it says = 3.
Right, and that's, if I go to the Google homepage, that's exactly what it does.
Yeah.
But in Firefox 4 under Linux Mint, at least, if I go to the Google search bar and I type 1 + 2 + 2. There is, in the Google search bar, there are a number of suggestions.
Right. Suggestions,
In the dropdown, and the top one is = 3. But if I actually press enter, what it takes me to is a Google search results page that does not include the equals three part of it.
So odd.
Yeah, so let me see if I do that in the URL bar. 1 + 2. Nothing. So, okay.
So Chrome is smarter, haha.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. All right, so that's so much for our review of Firefox versus Chrome. Yeah. And our scientific test.
That was very in-depth. There was a lot of research that went into that in the last few
seconds.
Oh, man, was
there ever. Okay. shall we get into our voicemails and emails and all that stuff, Tom?
That'd probably be a good idea.
Well, our first voicemail is from Steve McLaughlin, the door-to-door geek. And he has established an online forum and an online Linux users group using the Mumble server for the audio portion. And you can use Mumble from any operating system. Let's hear Steve's audio.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Tom. This is Steve McLaughlin, door-to-door geek. First, Larry, I have to say thank you for your how to podcast speech at scale. I've already sent it to two people. They found it very, very helpful. Thank you for that. Secondly, over at Linux Basics, LinuxBasics, we have started an online forum where our main goal is to help people. We share the knowledge that we have, and anyone can come in and ask any question they want. And we'll do everything we can to help them. All you need is Mumble, and the connection details are over at forum.linuxbasics.com under the category LUG. Mumble is 100% cross-platform, so if you have to boot into your Mac or boot into your Windows XP, Vista, or 7, load Mumble and connect from there. As always, guys, I thank you for the fantastic show. Please keep it up. Have a good week. Bye.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that. And we did try Mumble, and we did try his channel, and it works.
Yeah, it works very well, as a matter of fact. And I know we had a little bit of problem with Audacity on your end, but that had nothing to do with the Mumble server,
no.
We found out. We thought it might, but turns out it didn't. If we had proceeded, we might actually have had a studio audience for our recording, but maybe next time. Interesting.
That would be an idea, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There were a couple of people on the channel as we were setting up and doing our testing and stuff, and that would have been cool. So maybe in the future, we'll be able to do that. The nice thing about what Steve has done here is, in addition to having an online forum, he's also got an online Linux users group, or a LUG, and they actually meet online and use that Mumble server to hold the audio conversation. So Mumble is like Skype, except it's free and open source. And as Steve said in his voicemail, it works on Linux, Mac, and Windows. Mm-hmm. So it gives the LUG a way to talk to one another in real time. And they meet Fridays at 8 p.m., and that's 8 p.m. Eastern time in the United States, which is GMT minus 5. So if you're looking for an online LUG, or you don't have a LUG in your area, like the listener from New Hampshire had that problem, here's a way to join a LUG without having to travel cross country or to get to it.
Right. And one difference with Skype, you can set up a conference call. But with Mumble, anybody can just jump in.
Yeah, it's like an audio forum.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
In our next audio, the caller did not give a name.
Right.
So we're calling him Anonymous. And he, I think, was a little bit confused on how this works.
Yeah. Let's listen to what he has to say first.
Let's go ahead and listen, yeah. Sure.
I'd like to speak to Larry Bushy. Can I speak to Larry Bushy? I want to install Linux. I have two internal hard drives, and I got the C for the regular one, and I got an E and an L that's partitioned, and I want to make sure it goes on my L drive. how do I make sure that I installed the Linux on the L drive? I do not want to have it go on the C drive. Is there a way that I can do that? I appreciate you putting that on the air. I thought I'd be able to talk to somebody on the telephone and they could walk me through it.
So to be clear, it is a voicemail line.
Right.
You're not going to get me. You're not going to get Tom. You're going to get voicemail. So,
but to answer your question, yes, you can do that. But your L drive is not going to show up as an L drive. What you want to do is look at the sizes of each drive and write them down. So find out how big that L drive is. And then when you're doing your install, you'll see that size drive, and you go ahead and put Linux on there.
Right. And the other thing, depending on which distribution you're installing, it may give you the option to either A, install Linux to replace Windows, not what you want to do. Install Linux beside Windows, that's what you want to do, and you want to select the right partition from there. That L drive, as Tom said, will show up with its particular size. And then the third possibility is that it really doesn't describe it that way when you try to install, and it gives you the option to partition the hard drive, also something you don't want to do. You want to make sure that you choose the right partition. And if all of your partitions are the same size, then it's going to be a little more difficult. The other thing you could do, though, is you could see, even though the partitions may be the same size, it's very unlikely that you'll have the same amount of data on each partition. And when you go to install Ubuntu, for example, it shows the various partitions and how much of those partitions have data on them. So you might want to do a little bit of a check ahead of time. If it's Windows that you've got already installed on there, look at the L drive and see how big it is and see what percentage of that is actually taken up with data, and look for that when you're actually selecting the partition to install Ubuntu or whatever distribution you're installing.
And Larry, I'm pretty sure that when he gets to the critical point, it's going to warn him.
Yeah.
I'm about to wipe this drive. Are you sure you want to do that?
Right.
Okay. So you can go look safely without actually going. You can cancel at any time.
Yeah.
You can back out of there up until the point where you get the warning that says, we're about to do this. Are you sure?
Yeah, exactly. And once you reach that point, depending on which distribution of Linux you're installing, it may actually start partitioning your hard drive if that's what you asked it to do. So be careful. Make sure you don't say, yeah, go ahead. Okay.
Yeah.
This could be destructive, so be careful. So thanks, Anonymous.
Right. But don't worry. It's safe. Go look at it. And if you get to a point where you get scared, just get out of there and call us back.
Yeah. And as always, safe thing to do, make a backup of your
backup
before you start. Right. Yeah. All right. Our next voicemail is from Robert, who would like to start a Linux users group in his local community. Let's listen to Robert.
Hi. This is Robert Wilbur, and I'm wondering, I really enjoyed you guys' show, and I was wondering if I was to start maybe a Linux group or, you know, in local one in my community. How would I go about doing that, and what type of equipment stuff would I need? Okay, thanks. Bye.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. Larry, did we? I think we answered him, didn't we?
I think we did by email, but just for those of us listening who haven't heard that email or read that email, yeah, there are ways to start up your Linux users group or a local LUG, as it's called. One thing you could do is there's lots of information on Wikipedia about Linux users groups, and there are some external links right at the bottom there for different ideas and different ways to set up a Linux users group. And the first one is Linux users group How To by Rick Moen from June 2010. So it's fairly recent.
Right.
And that's probably a good one to go to. And the URL is www.tldp. That's Tango Lima Delta Papa .org/how-to/user-group-how-to.html. We'll have that in the show notes. Okay, well, let's get into our email, Tom. Our first one is from Bill, who discovered something that makes him very happy. He says, "Hi, Larry and Tom." Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
"I know you probably know this, but I just discovered this. Again, Google is your friend. Google.com/Linux. This returns Linux-specific search results. What a time saver. Bill." Well, Bill,
you have some bad news.
Yes, we do. Shall we let Steve break that to him, Tom?
Yeah, well, you're right. Let's let Steve break it to him. Steve says, "Hi, Tom and Larry." Hi, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
"It looks like google.com/Linux is a thing of the past." And he gives us a link to an article. "Just to say farewell to an old friend, you will be missed." And what it's about is Google, it used to be that if you went to google.com/Linux and did your search, you would find only Linux relevant results. And they have now pulled both /Linux, /Microsoft, /Mac, and /BSD. Doop, doop, doo. I don't know why. It says, "We are no longer offering specialized search services at google.com, blah, blah, blah." And it says, "These services were established many years ago to offer search across a limited index of the web, which in the past was a better way to find this information. Today, search quality has advanced tremendously, and based on our analysis, we found that in most cases, you're better off looking for this kind of specialized information using the regular Google search box." And I don't like it, but okay, it's Google.
Yeah, it's their stuff. They can do what they like with it. And here, I thought it was because it was just taking up too much space on the internet or something, you know?
Yeah.
We're running out of space there, you know?
The pipes were getting full.
Yeah, that's it. The pipes were getting clogged up. Okay, well, another utility down the drain. Oh, well.
Sorry about that, Bill.
Yeah, use Google. It'll still work.
Yeah.
Our next email is from John from the UK. He writes, "Hi, Tom and Larry." Hi, John.
Hi, John.
"I've just been listening to your podcast where you have been talking about the Unity desktop and how disappointed you were with it. I would like to put the other point of view, as I have been using it for about 6 months, first on my netbook and now on my desktop. The 10.10 netbook version was a real mess, but I slowly got used to it. I was very close to swapping to Linux Mint. The 11.04 versions are far better, and I have installed on both machines. They take a bit of getting used to, but stay with them. They're different, but good when you have tweaked them and got things how you want, just like when you first tried Ubuntu. They have installed straight from the CD and work well. Okay, there are some things that need to be polished, but it is well worth sticking with. Hope you keep going with it and enjoy the benefits. Best wishes and keep up the good work, John from the UK."
Now, you did give it a pretty good chance, didn't you, Larry?
I did. And, you know, I really did like it. It's just that it wasn't working for recording podcasts and doing some of the other stuff that I do. It handles all of the standard out-of-the-box, out-of-the-repository applications just fine. But that's not everything that I use on a day-to-day basis. And some of the stuff that I was using either crashed or didn't work properly. And I know it's just a matter of time before they fix those issues. So I'm willing to give it a little bit more time before I use it. That doesn't mean that if you're an average Linux user who, well, maybe the average Linux user doesn't fall into this category. But if you are a new Linux user, let's say, who uses Linux as an average computer user would to check their email and go on Facebook and, you know, browse the internet, it should work just fine for you. Ubuntu with Unity, no problem there at all. If you're a power user or an advanced user, you probably want to use something else until Canonical gets Unity up to speed.
And, you know, I've got exactly the opposite view. It's not new user friendly. You got to get in there and tweak stuff right out of the box. Well, now, I haven't tried it, but I've been talking to a lot of people who have.
Well, yes, and we have an upcoming email where people are talking about tweaking some stuff to make it work. But
sure. But John likes it, so other people must like it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's move along. We've got, hey, here's Brian. Brian says, hi, Tom and Larry.
Hi, Brian.
You notice I got top billing on the last two.
On the last two, yeah. People are listening, yeah.
And he says, I'm having quite a frustrating time with Vidalia Tor bundle. I never could get it to work in Linux Mint 10, but with my upgrade to Mint 11, it works and I'm able to host a node for the EFF. That's great, but now to my problem. Although I'm connected and my node is working, I can't seem to get my browser to use it. I've spent hours scouring the web for setup advice. I have my proxy settings set up according to the instructions found here, and he gives a long link, which we will include in the show notes. And I always get unable to connect to proxy server. I check the Synaptic and Poplio proxy is installed, and I believe Vidalia is supposed to start it automatically, but it doesn't show in the setup screen, and I'm at a loss as to what Poplio file should be there. The Tor button for Firefox won't work either. Help me, Obi, Larry, and Tom. I've never gotten Tor to work in 4 years of Linux. Love the show. Sincerely, Brian.
Well, and I did a little research, and actually Brian provided us with some screenshots of his screen as well, and it looks like there is a place where it's looking for you to enter the path to the Poplio file. And I don't know what Poplio is. I haven't done this. No. So, but I'm looking at the interface. I'm expecting that it's wanting you to tell it where Poplio is. So what I recommended to Brian is that he open a terminal and type in which, W-H-I-C-H, space, right. Poplio. And that should tell you where the executable file is for Poplio. Not only where the path is, but what the name of the file is. And then just copy and paste that into that space where it's asking you for. And maybe that'll make it work. But that's a shot in the dark on my part. So unless you have a suggestion, Tom, I'm going to suggest that maybe one of our listeners that is using Tor and Vidalia in particular might be able to help out.
Right. And I have not used Tor either. But Tor is free software, and I'm reading from their page. Tor is free software and an open network that helps you defend against a form of network surveillance that threatens personal freedom and privacy, confidential business activities and relationships, and state security known as traffic analysis. And what it does is there's a network of Tor users, and whatever you send or receive gets routed through other anonymous users. So at the end of the day, nobody can find out your IP address or where you live or that sort of thing.
Right. It anonymizes you on the internet.
Yeah, I would have said that, but it's much too big a word.
The words you used were just fine, Tom.
Okay. Right. Sorry, Brian, we don't have experience with it. If anybody knows how to help Brian, let us know.
Yeah. And our next email is from Prime Falcon, who provided us with this. Regarding backups, one thing that helps when upgrading between distribution versions is to have a separate home partition. This way you can upgrade, reinstall, and whatever, and keep all your data static. The only gotcha is on a fresh install, you need to chown the files after install. And that's pretty self-evident, right, Tom? We don't have to explain that, right? Chown.
That's C-H-O-W-N, change ownership.
Right. And so that's a command line command that allows you to change the ownership from whatever it was before to whatever it is now. And what he's talking about there is when you have a separate partition that houses your home folder, if the ownership, in other words, if your username is different when you install a fresh operating system, you have to go in and change the ownership from whatever your username used to be to whatever your username is now on the fresh install of your new operating system.
Yep, that's a good tip. Next time I do an install, I am going to make a separate home partition.
I keep wanting to do that.
That's just a good idea.
Yeah, I used to do that when I ran OpenSUSE, because that, when I first installed it, that was kind of the default way it was installed, and I just learned to do it that way, and it was quite handy. The other downside that I noticed, other than the ownership of the files issue, is that all of your settings are there, and if you have a new version of an application that comes with your fresh install, it's going to try to use the old settings, and most of the time, that works just fine.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes it's better to start with fresh settings for a new version of an application. So that's one other thing to be aware of.
Right. And thanks very much, Prime Falcon. Okay, so next up is Rich. And Rich provided a video with his email. And his comment is about hating it on my desktop, Unity. But he says this makes sense. And Larry, we'll include a link to the video in the show notes, but you want to just briefly describe the video?
Yeah. It's a video that shows someone who has installed Ubuntu 11.04 with Unity on a Dell tablet PC, and it's pretty obvious from the demonstration that Unity is perfect for a touch interface. So maybe that's where Canonical is pointing this thing, is to the tablet market.
Yeah, absolutely.
That defunct tablet PC market where most manufacturers aren't making them anymore, and any that are making tablets are installing either iPad software or Android on it.
Android, yeah.
So maybe they're hoping to take over some of the Android market with Unity. Whatever.
Whatever.
We'll see where it goes. We'll see.
I'm still not sold.
Yeah, me neither. Okay, this one is a long one from Mike. He's got some banshee problems on Linux Mint. Hey, have you noticed we're getting a lot more Linux Mint questions lately?
No kidding.
I'm wondering if there's a trend here. Mike writes, "Hi, Larry / Tom." Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
After some research, I recently upgraded to Linux Mint 11, and by and large, I have nothing bad to say about it. Been awesome. But I did find a minor little problem that's making me very curious. The podcast component of Banshee is literally missing on one machine. It's just, poof, gone. I've got the same distro running on two different boxes and a virtual machine. And only one of them has the issue. So I don't think it's a bug. Must have been a bump in the road during the upgrade. I'll attach a screenshot image just to prove I'm not crazy, at least not any crazier than usual. As far as issues go, they don't come any smaller. I just installed a different player for podcasts, but the hacker-nerd/curiosity in me won't let it go without a fight, and my attempts to research and fix it haven't worked out. So if you guys could keep an ear on the grapevine in case you heard something similar, I'd appreciate it. Oh, by the way, when I upgraded these systems, I used the process from here, and he provides a link to the Linux Mint community forum, and it's a tutorial on how to do the upgrade. The only thing I did different, and of course we'll include that in the show notes, the only thing I did differently on the working system versus the broken system is I didn't bother using the steps with the backup tool. I just copied my home directory with the good old-fashioned cp command and then copied it back after the upgrade. On the broken system, I used the mint update tool that it mentions in the link. One of the steps in there involves backup/restore software selection. I wonder if maybe I got some sort of weird package conflict between the old version of Banshee and 2.0. Okay, I'm rambling. Thanks, fellas. Keep up the podcast. Mike. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I was talking about just a moment ago, Tom, on the separate partition for your home directory. And it's possible, Mike, that you're seeing that one of the settings from the older version of Banshee didn't carry over properly in the upgrade process, and it was trying to use that old setting, and it just completely wiped out the podcasts section. Yeah, I'm not guaranteeing that that's what's going on, and I don't know for sure. I think you're right. I don't think it's a bug, but I do think it has something to do with the fact that you installed it differently on this particular computer, and maybe that CP command didn't copy over some things that that Banshee needed, depending on which switches you used on the CP command.
Right, and just to make sure, I just hit apt-get install Banshee, and it's installing Banshee 1.6.1.
On Ubuntu 10.04, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And we'll see in just a few moments, with the miracle of audio editing, whether or not that works.
And once again, Tom, you are, you know, unscrewing the bolts on the plane as we're flying it.
Yeah. How many bolts can I pull out before the engine falls off?
And thanks to Nightwise for that great visual.
Installing 14 assemblies.
Ooh.
Huh. Okay, Banshee is installed. Opening Banshee. And yes, it does have a podcast function. So why yours is missing, that's a little bit of a puzzle. And our next email is from Paul, who's going to rant a little bit here, I think. Mm-hmm. He says, hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, Paul.
Paul says, this is going to be a venting session, so I apologize in advance. I've been running Linux as a desktop for the past year. My experience with Linux has had fluctuations. When it's running smoothly, it's fantastic. When I come up with a stumbling block, I feel annoyed. Playing streaming video and audio from the internet is something that I love to do. However, I believe that the task is quite complicated within Linux. My experience with Windows has been much more positive in this department. I understand the support for protocols such as MMS, Microsoft Media Server, can have complications within a free operating system which supports free and open source software. Though what I do not understand is that I may be able to play some formats within some video players, though unable to play the same formats in other video players within Linux. I understand that finding codecs in the past, even with Microsoft Windows, has been difficult. Though, once these codecs have been installed, it appears that they can be used and shared between all media playing software on the system. With the click of a button within Firefox, in a Windows environment, a video player appears and plays the content immediately. Within a Linux environment, I click a link, and at present, GNOME mPlayer loads. And then I say a prayer and hope the link loads. Then if it doesn't load, I can have the ability to copy the link and play it in KMPlayer. What I don't understand is why can a link work in KMPlayer and not GNOME mPlayer, when in theory they are both interfaces to the same mPlayer software? And as a user, why should I need to copy and paste a link from one software to another? Also, Firefox. I really enjoy using it, though again can't understand why when upgrades occur, plugins become incompatible, such as VLC. I can't even use the VLC plugin to play links automatically. I have Firefox 4.0.1. Why is this the case? It appears that some of these software packages are unprofessionally built, although what's to blame in this circumstance? Why is the process so much easier with Windows than in Linux using the same packages? Is it the fault of the software or the operating system? I hope that these issues get resolved quickly, as I'm getting all the more tempted to switch back to, and he says the W word. I would prefer to avoid this, but if possible, though I have been unable to find a resolution and am losing my patience. Thank you for allowing me to vent. Thanks for your program. You guys are doing an amazing job. Regards, Paul. Paul.
Yeah, you're running into one of the little idiosyncrasies with Linux. And you mentioned, why is it not professionally built? Because in some cases, it's not professionals building it, quite right. frankly. Although I do have to say that the quality of the software from the, quote, non-professionals is often better than from the, quote, professionals. So I'm not dissing the open source development folks by any stretch here. But there are some features that, you know, do get overlooked a little bit now and again, and eventually they get fixed and the holes get plugged, and it takes a little longer sometimes than with Windows, but sometimes it actually happens faster. So there's some right. puts and takes. I certainly understand your frustration.
Yeah, this is, it's not being put together by a bunch of guys all in the same office. You've got somebody in Germany working on one package and going off in their own direction, and somebody in Sweden or Japan or wherever, and you gather these things together, and they're not really cross-linked very well because they weren't meant to be. That being said, VLC Media Player will play just about anything. And if you want YouTube to play really, 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 really well, listen to my software pick at the end of this thing in a few minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, and as far as your problems with Firefox plugins 4.01, as we said in the previous couple of emails, sometimes those settings aren't transferable. And sometimes the upgrade to the new version is so significantly different that even those plugins have to be rewritten. And it may be that the VLC plugin that you have for Firefox version 3 isn't compatible with Firefox version 4. And it's simply a matter of going into the tools and plugins on Firefox and upgrading that, and it will work just fine. Although I haven't tried that on mine since upgrading to Firefox 4 myself. I have yet to bump into anything that was a problem with playing media. But then again, maybe I'm not using the VLC plugin. I haven't checked.
I've had Firefox upgrades where after the upgrade, it came along and it said, this plugin that you have installed is no longer supported.
Yeah.
Or will no longer work. Yeah. I haven't seen that in Chrome updates yet, though.
Okay. Well, there you go. One more tally on the Chrome side of the comparison.
Yeah.
Well, and Paul also wrote in later with a topic suggestion and an apology. So okay. He says, hi, Larry and Tom. Hi, Paul.
Hi again, Paul.
I did rant a bit on my last email and apologize. I have since submitted a bug report with Gecko Player, and I am awaiting a fix. Now, that's exactly the right thing to do, Paul.
There you go.
That's how you become part of the Linux community, as opposed to us who just tend to complain. But anyway.
Should we be putting in a bug report for Unity?
For the whole thing?
For the whole works, yeah.
I'm not sure that would go down too well, Tom. Complaining, I think, is the right thing to do here. I do, though, stick to the principles to my ranting, though, and believe that ensuring that the basic internet applications work with Linux is essential to Linux's growth. I do not want Linux to be associated with an operating system that is always behind in some feature to its Microsoft cousin. P.S. on a totally different topic, do you think you can do an episode on how to actually install different desktop environments such as GNOME and KDE? From memory, in the past, you may have discussed that there were different desktops available, though I don't think that you may have given advice on how to install a desktop environment. Thanks again for your show. Regards, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not sure that actually would take up a whole episode, Tom.
No, we can tell them right now.
Yeah. So, on Ubuntu, how would you install? Let's say you're on Ubuntu 10.04, as you are. If you wanted the Kubuntu interface, the KDE interface for Kubuntu, what would you do?
Well, Larry, I would click on System, Administration, and then go down to the Synaptic Package Manager. Enter my password.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell I'm doing it right now?
Yes, yes. More bolts falling off this mid-flight.
Okay, up in the search box, I would type Kubuntu, K-U-P-U-N-T-U. And there I see Kubuntu-desktop.
Yep, and that's the one. Please don't install it, Tom, because you'll be installing all the KDE dependencies and all the KDE applications and all that, and we'll be waiting for a while.
Okay, I'll leave that bolt screwed in.
Yeah, yeah, tighten it up a little, will you?
Yeah, select that, hit apply, and once it's all installed, then log out. And before you log back in, you'll see that you can switch between whatever you're currently using and Kubuntu.
Right, and it's right there on the login page where you type in your username and password. And it's at the bottom on Ubuntu, right at the bottom. There's a little pull down or pull up list where you can choose the user environment that you want to switch to. So that's pretty much the same sort of process on any distribution of Linux to add a new desktop environment is go into the package manager and choose that desktop environment. Of course, with Ubuntu and Kubuntu, they have a special name, and that Kubuntu-desktop package pulls in everything, all the Ubuntu provided KDE related special packages as well. And if all you really want is just the bare bones KDE, then you would search for just KDE, and it will bring that in. But of course, there may be some other dependencies that you want and some tweaks. Similarly on Linux Mint and other distributions. And so you might want to try that out and see what's in there in terms of the package manager and look at what other things are related to KDE that you might want to pull in. So it's really a matter of finding KDE in the package manager and installing it. And in most cases, the package manager will pull in whatever dependencies are needed to make KDE work. And quite frankly, it'll probably pull in all of the other packages like the text editor for KDE and the file manager for KDE, and all of those things just come with KDE.
Right.
So you'll find a whole lot more software installed along with the desktop environment.
I'm seeing I typed KDE into the search box.
Mm-hmm.
And I've scrolled down several pages, and the scroll bar hasn't moved much. So it looks like there are thousands of files here, and which one you would want, I don't know. So you're better off with Kubuntu.
Yeah, in the Ubuntu example, absolutely, because it knows what it needs. So Jared wrote us our next email, and he also suggested a topic. He says, hi, guys. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Jared.
I'm sure you're already thinking about this topic, but it would make an interesting discussion on your show. Since Microsoft has acquired Skype, I'm a little nervous that support on Linux could fade or even disappear completely. Are there any cross-platform alternatives to Skype? Mumble. I also wanted to report that I have converted my 70-year-old father over to Linux.
Yay!
I think the transition pain is extremely overrated. He has asked me only one question since I installed it on his computer. How to increase the font size in Chrome. Ha! Talk about easy tech support. Cheers, Jared. And if he's 70 years old, I understand why he needs to increase the font size in Chrome. So that's quite fine. And I'm glad you had some good success there, Jared. So shall we answer his question? Mumble.
Yeah, there's Mumble, there's TeamSpeak, there's several things out there. But what's worrying me is I use Skype for my home phone.
Yeah.
And Skype will give you a phone number that costs something like $3 a month to have the phone number. So it's way cheaper than having a phone. And when Microsoft screws it, I mean Microsoft and support, I lose my phone.
Yeah.
I don't know another service that'll give me a phone number other than Magic Jack, which only runs on, I think, Windows and Mac. So I'm going to run Magic Jack in a virtual machine.
Not so good. Yeah. And things like Mumble and TeamSpeak, of course, are not in the same order of magnitude of quality as Skype, where they host the server and all you really need to do is sign up with an account. With Mumble, you need to have a server to go to, and everybody has to connect on that server, and it's not as easy a setup, for sure, as Skype is.
Right. With Skype, the server is distributed. The users are the server.
Right. And maybe services like Mumble and TeamSpeak can get to that point. But right now, I don't see a lot of cross-platform alternatives with the same feature set that Skype has. So I'm hoping that Microsoft doesn't do the same sorts of things with Skype that it's been doing with Microsoft Office that I've been experiencing at work. For example, Microsoft has used a strategy to force people to upgrade to Office 2010 by saying that it's completely compatible with all the old versions of documents from Microsoft Office 2003 and previous versions, except that in business, people use spreadsheets a lot. And what they've done is they have changed some of the formulas so that if you're using Office 2010, the formulas work. But if you try to save a file that you've created with those new formulas in an older version, it'll save, but it'll say that some of the features you're using are incompatible with this older version. You must get those other people to upgrade to Office 2010 in order to make your experience completely compatible. And the same thing with formatting documents, something as simple as fonts and colors and things like that.
Yeah.
They have made it so that users who have upgraded are forcing users who don't want to upgrade just because they can't save the file in a compatible old format, even though they tell you you can. And I hope they don't do that sort of thing with Skype. That would be disastrous.
If you read the Microsoft end user license agreement, it says right in there.
Okay. I believe it. So, Jared, I don't know. I don't really have a good alternative to Skype at this point, but I'm sure there are a lot of people working feverishly trying to make that happen.
I hope.
Yeah.
Well, next up, Brian provides a link to an article with four tweaks to bring back missing functionality in GNOME 3. And I just really ticked somebody off by pronouncing the G in GNOME. We'll include the link in our show notes. The missing features include the shutdown and restart menu buttons, files and icons on the desktop not being displayed, persistent dock missing from the desktop, and minimizing and maximizing buttons are missing. So he's got ways to put that back, and we will put the link in the show notes, even though it's not actually on this document.
Yeah, I forgot to put it there, but I'll go back to Brian's email and paste it in there. Okay. And we'll put it in our show notes as well, of course. All right, and our last email is from Rick, who's provided us with our Gone Linux story for this episode. Hello, Tom. Hello, Larry.
Hello.
Hello, Rick.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Let's do these. We did them one at a time, so let's do them one at a time.
All right. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Rick.
Hello, Larry. Hi, Rick. I've listened to your podcast for some time, and you are my favorite Linux podcast. I just finished listening to the most recent feedback episode, and it reminded me that I was going to share a Gone Linux story, perhaps of a different nature. I have an Acer Aspire 1 netbook. I purchased it a couple of years ago, and I was traveling a great deal for work and wanted something small. I purchased the version with just the solid-state drive and use SD memory cards for expansion. Of course, it came with that other operating system. I had been playing with Linux for a year or so before the purchase, first on Ubuntu and then moving to Linux Mint. I started out running Linux on the netbook by using a pen drive. I ran an initial benchmark comparing boot time from power on to the surfing the web. Windows took about 8 minutes. Linux Mint Helena had me surfing in a little over 3 minutes, on a pen drive, no less.
Wow.
It wasn't long before Linux Mint was installed to the solid-state drive. I did experience some hiccups going to Linux Mint Isidore, long-term support release. I had a problem with the touchpad, sound, and intermittent lockup with blank screen. Over time, I have resolved them. And as an aside, Tom, I think that has more to do with Acer proprietary hardware than it has to do with Linux Mint. So continuing, my Acer seems to be pretty happy. However, a few weeks ago, something happened, and it refused to boot. It would show part of the screen and then just turn itself off. I tried booting from a memory stick and a live CD, and the problem persisted. I didn't know if I had a hardware problem or what, so I decided to break out the original Windows recovery disk to see if I could get it to install. It failed also. However, I guess the threat worked. The netbook booted to Linux Mint and sprang to life. It has been running flawlessly ever since. Yes, threatening your computer to reinstall Windows often does fix Linux problems.
It's like waterboarding.
Rick's comments continue. I guess I just needed to threaten it with the, quote, other operating system. So my netbook has gone Linux. Thank you for all you do. I have learned so very much from your podcast. You make them great. I'm glad you have Tom on board, as I am a fairly new Linux user and can really relate to the trials he experiences. And I usually take away some great nuggets of knowledge. Rick. Well, Rick, thanks. That is definitely a little different, Gonlytics.
Yeah, the trials that I experience are generally self-inflicted.
As we've discussed before.
Yes.
Okay. All right, well.
I guess that's about a wrap for now. We've got more, but I think we should wrap it about
yes,
here.
I think so. And it's becoming obvious that we can't get to all the email. So what we don't get to on the show, we'll respond to by email and vice versa.
Sure.
Okay, so my software pick, Tom.
Do it.
Yeah, it's Mumble. And it is in the repositories. You don't have to go to a website and install it from a scary, unvetted site. It's right there, at least in Linux Mint and in Ubuntu. It's right there.
Yeah.
It's an alternative to Skype. It has built-in recording, at least if you have the latest version of Mumble. I think the previous version before 1.2.3 did not include that recording, but the recording works pretty well. I have noticed there's a bit of a lag on some podcasts, like the Mintcast seems to experience that a lot. And I'm not sure why, because in our tests, Tom, there was absolutely no lag that I could detect.
And I couldn't either.
And I haven't heard a lag on the Linux Basics podcast. So I don't know what they're doing different, but maybe it's someone has a very slow internet connection or something among their hosts. And they have a large number of hosts, too. So sure. Not sure. But anyway, that's my software pick, Mumble. Give it a try. And
I'll endorse that one, too, except the audio setup wizard worked very weirdly for me. So.
Yeah, it's not your plug it in and it just works. You do have to tweak it to get the right settings. And we're still tweaking.
Yeah, we are. I found nothing productive came out of that audio setup wizard, except I was severely annoyed.
Yeah, well.
But it's an excellent package after that.
Yeah, it works. It's rock solid. It works great.
Right. And my software pick is something called Minitube. And the application opens, and there's a little search box up on top. So what do you want to see videos about? And you can type whatever in there. Grafting apple trees, or setting up Linux, or whatever. And it'll go find YouTube videos on the subject and play them one after another.
Huh.
And,
you know, I've heard of this. I have heard of this. Minitube, yeah.
Yeah. it'll go full screen. It's got lots of nice features. You can search by most relevant, most recent, or most viewed. And what I really like about it is on my little netbook, when I go to YouTube and watch videos in Flash, if they're higher resolution, they're going to be jerky.
Hmm.
Okay. So I have to manually pull the resolution down. Well, on this, I don't think it's playing Flash. I think it's some kind of a native player.
Aha. So
I never see that hesitation and jerkiness.
Well, maybe it's HTML5 they're using.
Could be. Don't know.
Yeah, I have to do a little research on that.
Whatever it is, it works. But Minitube, it's in the Ubuntu repositories.
Great. Yeah, far be it from us for letting lack of research allow us to review an application on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Tom. I'll have to give that a try.
Yeah, give it a shot. I like it.
Yeah, good. Our next episode is Computer America, and Carrie is no longer a host on Computer America.
Oh, really?
Yes. Craig has cut him loose. You can listen to Carrie over on Tech Vets. He has a podcast over there with Mike Smith that he's been doing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And their focus is on people who are tech support folks, who support folks with computers. And over on Computer America, just one day, Carrie stopped being the co-host, and Craig's son is now the co-host.
Oh, okay.
So nepotism is alive and well.
Well, that's kind of too bad, because Carrie was coming around as far as Linux was concerned.
I know. So maybe Carrie and I will hook up again somewhere. He's hoping to be able to have a radio show again of his own somewhere. And good luck to him on that. In the meantime, he's got the Tech Vets podcast with Mike Smith, and go look that up. It's Tech-Vets you want to search for, because there is another Tech Vets without the dash.
Wow.
And until that Computer America episode, you can go to our articles and show notes at our website, which is, of course, goinglinux.com. And you can get more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, illustrations, and lots of other stuff there.
Right. And you can email us with your comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button on our page to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
Yeah, and I know Podcast Alley has had a few hiccups and quirks every once in a while. It seems to be working okay. They still have a little bit of fixing to do, but you can still go and vote, so that's great. Thank you for those who have commented and voted.
Right.
And you can also send us an audio comment by email. If you like, you will play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our voicemail number is 1-904-468-7889, which, of course, is on North America Keyboards, 1-904-4-HOUR-TUX.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. The handle is goinglinux, all one word.
And you can download our episodes from our website, or you can play them right there on the show notes page using the HTML5 or the Flash player, and enjoy the shows right there from your browser. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.